undemocratic intent. The undemocratic intent behind fascist propaganda is key. Fascist states focus on dismantling the rule of law, with the goal of replacing it with the dictates of individual rulers or party bosses. It is standard in fascist politics for harsh criticisms of an independent judiciary to occur in the form of accusations of bias, a kind of corruption, critiques that are then used to replace independent judges with ones who will cynically employ the law as a means to protect the interests of the ruling party. The recent rapid transition of certain apparently successful democratic states, such as Hungary and Poland, to non-democratic rule has made this tactic of undermining the independent judiciary particularly salient, as both countries introduced laws to replace independent judges with party loyalists soon after anti-democratic regimes took power. Officially, the justification was that prior practices of judicial neutrality were a mask for bias against the ruling party. In the name of rooting out corruption and supposed bias, fascist politicians attack and diminish the institutions that might otherwise check their power. Just as fascist politics attacks the rule of law in the name of anti-corruption, it also purports to protect freedom and individual liberties. But these liberties are contingent on the oppression of some groups. On July 5, 1852, the American abolitionist and orator, Frederick Douglass, delivered a 4th of July oration in honor of that year's Independence Day. Douglass begins his remarks by acknowledging that the day celebrates political freedom. This, for the purpose of this celebration, is the 4th of July. It is the birthday of your national independence and of your political freedom. This, to you, is what the Passover was to the emancipated people of God. Douglass spends the first part of his speech lauding the Founding Fathers' commitment to the cause of liberty and praising the day as a celebration of the ideal of freedom. But then, turning to the present moment, Douglass, who was formerly enslaved, asks, "To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today?" In this famous speech entitled, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July?" Douglass calls out the hypocrisy of a country that practices human slavery while celebrating the ideal of liberty. Americans in the 19th century, including those who lived in the South, regarded their land as a beacon of liberty. "How is this possible," Douglass asked, "when it was built by the labor of enslaved Africans and a native population whose land rights and often rights to life were thoroughly ignored?" The rhetoric of liberty was effective in this situation because of a widespread belief that the native population, as well as the imported enslaved population from Africa, were not suitable recipients of the goods of liberty. This is classic fascist ideology with a hierarchy of value of worth between races. The rhetoric of liberty worked during the Confederacy by explicitly tying white Southerners' liberties to the practice of slavery. "When others are doing the labor for you, you are free to do as you please, at least superficially." The liberty involved in the leisurely life of the Southern planter was intimately bound up with the doctrine of white racial superiority. Under these structural conditions, the very notion of liberty in the South was predicated on its perversion in the practice of slavery. We find this inversion in much of the rhetoric of states' rights, a phrase used to defend the liberty of U.S. states in the South from federal intervention. But the federal intervention that is most associated with the call for states' rights is the elimination of slavery and subsequently Jim Crow laws restricting the right to vote for black citizens. The liberty that many whites in southern states sought by calling for states' rights was the freedom to restrict the liberties of their fellow black citizens. Historically, fascist leaders have often come to power through democratic elections. But the commitment to freedom, such as the freedom inherent in the right to vote, tends to end with that victory. In Mein Kampf, after excoriating parliamentary democracy, Hitler praises true Germanic democracy with free choice of the leader along with his obligation to assume entire responsibility for all he does and causes to be done. What Hitler here describes is absolute rule by a leader after an initial democratic vote. There is no suggestion in Hitler's description of what he calls true Germanic democracy that the leader must subject himself to a subsequent election. Hitler is here also drawing on the mythic past, when medieval German kings were elected for life. Whatever this system is, it is not recognizably democracy. In the Confederacy's use of the concept of liberty to defend the practice of slavery, the Southern states call for states' rights to defend slavery, and Hitler's presentation of dictatorial rule as democracy, liberal democratic ideals are used as a mask to undermine themselves. In each, we can find specious arguments that the anti-liberal goal is in fact a realization of the liberal ideal. In the case of the Confederacy and the Jim Crow U.S. South, the argument was that states' rights, a manifestation of the liberal ideal of self-determination, allowed for the practice of racial subordination, as this was a choice made by each state. Hitler argues that true Germanic democracy, that is, dictatorship by a single individual, is genuine democracy, because only in such a system does genuine individual responsibility for political decisions exist, as the power to make those decisions rests with one person, and individual responsibility is a liberal notion par excellence. In Book 8 of Plato's Republic, Socrates argues that people are not naturally led to self-governance, but rather seek a strong leader to follow. Democracy, by permitting freedom of speech, opens the door for a demagogue to exploit the people's need for a strong man. The strong man will use this freedom to prey on the people's resentments and fears. Once the strong man seizes power, he will end democracy, replacing it with tyranny. In short, Book 8 of The Republic argues that democracy is a self-undermining system whose very ideals lead to its own demise. Fascists have always been well acquainted with this recipe for using democracy's liberties against itself. Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels once declared, "This will always remain one of the best jokes of democracy, that it gave its deadly enemies the means by which it was destroyed." Today is no different from the past. Again, we find the enemies of liberal democracy employing this strategy, pushing the freedom of speech to its limits and ultimately using it to subvert others' speech. Desiree Fairouz is a former librarian and activist who was present at the confirmation hearing of U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Sessions is a former Alabama senator whose nomination to the federal bench had been rejected by the U.S. Senate in 1986 over accusations of far-right extremism, particularly racism. As a senator, Sessions had made a name for himself by fomenting panic about immigration. When Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama declared that Sessions had a well-documented record of treating all Americans equally under the law, Fairouz chuckled. She was immediately arrested and charged with disruptive and disorderly conduct. The Justice Department, headed by Sessions, pressed charges against her. After a judge dismissed the charges in the summer of 2017 on the grounds that laughter is permitted speech, Sessions' Justice Department decided in September 2017 to continue to pursue charges against her. It was not until November of that year that the Justice Department abandoned its attempt to bring Fairuz to trial for chuckling. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is hardly a defender of free speech. And yet, the very same month that his Justice Department was again attempting to bring an American citizen to trial for laughing, Sessions delivered a speech at Georgetown Law School excoriating university campuses for failing to live up to a commitment to free speech because of the presumption that the academy discourages right-leaning voices. He called for a national recommitment to free speech and the First Amendment. In the week Sessions gave this speech, news was dominated by President Trump's call for the owners of National Football League teams to fire players who knelt during the national anthem to protest racism, an exercise of First Amendment rights if ever there was one. United States politics has recently been dominated by pro-free speech rhetoric from far-right nationalists. The regular pro-Trump rallies in Portland, Oregon are called Trump Free Speech Rallies. In May 2017, the city was the site of a particularly brutal white nationalist terrorist act when Jeremy Joseph Christian, a 35-year-old far-right nationalist, allegedly stabbed three people who tried to intervene as he was hurling anti-Muslim insults at two young women. Two of the stabbing victims died from their injuries. When entering the courtroom to be arraigned, Christian shouted, "Free speech or die, Portland. You got no safe place. This is America. Get out if you don't like free speech. You call it terrorism, I call it patriotism." The chief reason we have free speech in democracy is to facilitate public discourse about policy on the part of citizens and their representatives. But the kind of debate where one shrieks insults at another, not to mention engages in physical violence and then denounces protest as an attack on speech, is not the relevant kind of public discourse that free speech rights are meant to protect. The kind of speech that Jeremy Joseph Christian wished to engage in destroys the possibility of, rather than facilitates, public discourse. It is often noted, rightly, that fascism elevates the irrational over the rational, fanatical emotion over the intellect. It is less often remarked upon, however, that fascism performs this elevation indirectly, that is to say, propagandistically. The Rhetoric of Hitler's Battle is a 1939 essay by the American literary theorist Kenneth Burke. In it, Burke describes how Hitler in Mein Kampf repeatedly describes his struggle to embrace National Socialist ideals, such as the realization that life is a battle for power between groups in which reason and objectivity have no role, his realization that humans are beasts, and his rejection of the Enlightenment as driven by reason. Burke writes, "Those who attack Hitlerism as a cult of the irrational should amend their statements to this extent. Irrational it is, but it is carried on under the slogan of reason. Fascists reject Enlightenment ideals while proclaiming that they are forced to do so by a stark confrontation with reality, by the natural law." As Burke notes, Hitler describes his transition into a fanatical anti-Semite as a struggle of reason and reality against his heart. The fascist claims to have been driven by scientific reason to the view that life is a merciless struggle for dominance in which the very force that has allegedly brought him to this, the Enlightenment ideal of universal reason, must be abandoned. Chapter 3. Anti-Intellectual. Fascist politics seeks to undermine public discourse by attacking and devaluing education, expertise, and language. Intelligent debate is impossible without an education, with access to different perspectives, a respect for expertise when one's own knowledge gives out, and a rich enough language to precisely describe reality. When education, expertise, and linguistic distinctions are undermined, there remains only power and tribal identity. This does not mean that there is no role for universities in fascist politics. In fascist ideology, there is only one legitimate viewpoint, that of the dominant nation. Schools introduce students to the dominant culture and its mythic past. Education, therefore, either poses a grave threat to fascism or becomes a pillar of support for the mythical nation. It's no wonder, then, that protests and cultural clashes on campuses represent a true political battleground and receive national attention. The stakes are high. For at least the past 50 years, universities have been the epicenter of protest against injustice and authoritarian overreach. Consider, for example, their unique role in the anti-war movement of the 1960s. Where speech is a right, propagandists cannot attack dissent head-on. Instead, they must represent it as something violent and oppressive. A protest, therefore, becomes a riot. In 2015, the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States, protesting police brutality and racial inequality, spread to university campuses. Given that Black Lives Matter began in Ferguson, Missouri, it is no surprise that the first campus it touched was the University of Missouri. Concerned Student 1950 was the name of the Missouri student movement, named to evoke the year in which the University of Missouri was desegregated. Among its aims was to address the incidents of racial abuse that black students faced on a regular basis, as well as addressing curricula that represented culture and civilization as the product solely of white men. The media largely ignored these motivations and, representing protesting black students as an angry mob, used the situation as an opportunity to foment rage against the supposed liberal political excesses of the university. Fascist politics seeks to undermine the credibility of institutions that harbor independent voices of dissent until they can be replaced by media and universities that reject those voices. One typical method is to level accusations of hypocrisy. Right now, a contemporary right-wing campaign is charging universities with hypocrisy on the issue of free speech. Universities, they say, claim to hold free speech in the highest regard, but suppress any voices that don't lean left by allowing protests against them on campus. Most recently, critics of campus social justice movements have found an effective method of turning themselves into the victims of protest. They contend that protesters mean to deny them their own free speech. These accusations extend into the classroom. David Horowitz is a far-right activist who has been targeting universities and the film industry since the 1980s. In 2006, Horowitz published a book, The Professors, naming the 101 Most Dangerous Professors in America, a list of leftist and liberal professors, many of whom were supporters of Palestinian rights. In 2009, he published another book, One Party Classroom, with a list of the 150 most dangerous courses in America. Horowitz has created numerous organizations to promote his ideas. In the 1990s, Horowitz created the Individual Rights Foundation, which, according to the conservative Young America's Foundation, led the battle against speech codes on college campuses. In 1992, he founded the monthly tabloid Heterodoxy, which, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, targeted university students whom Horowitz viewed as being indoctrinated by the entrenched left in American academia. Horowitz is also responsible for Students for Academic Freedom, which was called the Campaign for Fairness and Inclusion in Higher Education when it was introduced in 2003. The goal of Students for Academic Freedom is to promote the hiring of professors with conservative worldviews, an effort marketed as promoting intellectual diversity and academic freedom at America's colleges and universities, according to Young America's Foundation. For the past several decades, Horowitz was a fringe figure on the American far right. More recently, his tactics and aims, and even his rhetoric, have moved into the mainstream, where attacks on political correctness on campuses are now commonplace. The Trump administration has aggressively pursued Horowitz's agenda. Deputy Associate Attorney General of the U.S. Department of Justice, Jesse Panuccio, began a speech at Northwestern University on January 26, 2018, by declaring campus free speech a vitally important topic and, as you are probably aware, one that Attorney General Sessions has made a priority for the Department of Justice. It is a priority because, in our view, many campuses across the country are failing to protect and promote free speech. Trump's presidential campaign is sometimes described as one long attack on political correctness. It is not accidental that the rhetoric of the Trump administration, in particular its attacks on political correctness and its use of free speech rhetoric, overlaps with the talking points of some of the well-funded institutions that have arisen to attack and delegitimize universities as bastions of liberalism. There are links between Horowitz's main organization, the David Horowitz Freedom Center, DHFC, and the Trump administration, especially with its members on the far right. According to an investigation by the Washington Post, published in June 2017, the DHFC has supported political operatives whose aim has been to destabilize establishment Washington politics, tilting it to the far right, including Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Senior Policy Advisor Stephen Miller, and Stephen Bannon. According to the article on December 14, 2016, Horowitz expressed happiness about Trump's victory and said Republicans had finally woken up to his approach to politics, denouncing leftists as enemies of free speech. Horowitz counts at least 11 one-time members of the Trump administration as supporters of the DHFC, including Vice President Mike Pence, Sessions, Bannon, and Miller, whom Horowitz legitimately describes as a kind of protege of mine. The article documents Horowitz's lengthy support for Miller's career. The center has been deeply involved in the careers of senior Trump administrative officials for many years, and according to the Post's investigation, has long served as a sort of informal gathering place for the far-right members of the administration. Horowitz's free speech attacks on universities lack legitimacy. Given the formal protections of academic freedom, universities in the United States host the freest domain of expression of any workplace. In private workplaces in the United States, free speech is a fantasy. Workers are regularly subjected to non-disclosure agreements, forbidding them to speak about various matters. In most workplaces, workers can be fired for political speech on social media. Attacking the only workplaces in a country with genuine free speech protections using the ideal of free speech is another instance of the familiar Orwellian nature of propaganda. In January 2017, Missouri State Representative Rick Bratton amended a bill he had previously introduced to the state legislature to ban tenure at all of Missouri's public universities. After calling tenure un-American in an interview with the Chronicle of Higher Education, Bratton added, "Something's wrong, something's broken, and a professor that should be educating our kids should be concentrating on ensuring that they're propelling to a better future, but instead are engaging in political stuff that they shouldn't be engaged in. Because they have tenure, they're allowed to do so, and that is wrong." When Bratton was asked whether he was concerned that eliminating tenure would damage academic freedom and lead to professors losing their jobs for political reasons, he responded by asking in what other profession people have that freedom and why academia should be a special case. The work that scholars produce may necessarily have political implications, depending on the field. Attacks from the right make clear the right wing's own desire to control acceptable lines of inquiry. In the classic style of demagogic propaganda, the tactic of attacking institutions standing up for public reason and open debate occurs under the cloak of those very ideals. Within universities, fascist politicians target professors they deem too political, typically too Marxist, and denounce entire areas of study. When fascist movements are underway in liberal democratic states, certain academic disciplines are singled out. Gender studies, for instance, comes under fire from far-right nationalist movements across the world. The professors and teachers in these fields are accused of disrespect to the traditions of the nation. Whenever fascism threatens, its representatives and facilitators denounce universities and schools as sources of Marxist indoctrination, the classic boogeyman of fascist politics. Typically used without any connection to Marx or Marxism, the expression is employed in fascist politics as a way to malign equality. That is why universities that seek to give some intellectual space to marginalized perspectives, however small, are subject to denunciation as hotbeds of Marxism. Fascism is about the dominant perspective, and so, during fascist moments, there is strong support for figures to denounce disciplines that teach perspectives other than the dominant ones, such as gender studies or, in the United States, African-American studies or Middle Eastern studies. The dominant perspective is often misrepresented as the truth, the real history, and any attempt to allow a space for alternative perspectives is derided as cultural Marxism. Fascist opposition to gender studies, in particular, flows from its patriarchal ideology. National socialism targeted women's movements and feminism generally. For the Nazis, feminism was a Jewish conspiracy to destroy fertility among Aryan women. Charu Gupta aptly summarizes the Nazi attitude toward feminist movements. Nazis believed that the women's movement was part of an international Jewish conspiracy to subvert the German family and thus destroy the German race. The movement, it claimed, was encouraging women to assert their economic independence and to neglect their proper task of producing children. It was spreading the feminine doctrines of pacifism, democracy, and materialism. By encouraging contraception and abortion, and so lowering the birth rate, it was attacking the very existence of the German people. In fascist attacks on universities, the universities play the role of the Nazi Jewish conspiracy behind the women's movement. Universities subvert masculinity and undermine the traditional family by supporting gender studies. In Russia, Vladimir Putin has gone on the offensive on this issue, repurposing universities into ideological weapons directed against the supposed Western excesses of feminism. In her 2017 book, The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, the journalist Masha Gessen describes how Russia's anti-gay, anti-feminist university agenda emerged out of a 1997 conference in Prague called the World Congress of Families, organized by Alan Carlson, an American historian at the ultra-conservative Hillsdale College in Michigan. The conference had a large turnout. Gessen writes, "Inspired by the turnout, the organizers turned the World Congress of Families into a permanent organization dedicated to the fight against gay rights, abortion rights, and gender studies." As one example of policies inspired by the conference, the Russian government persecuted the European University of St. Petersburg for its liberal inclinations. Russian authorities have been trying to close it down for years, and finally succeeded in 2016 when its teaching license was suspended. According to the university, The inspections were instigated by an official complaint from Vitaly Milonov, a member of the Russian parliament for Vladimir Putin's United Russia Party, who is responsible for some of Russia's extreme anti-gay legislation. Milonov expressed concern about the teaching of gender studies at the university. "I personally find that disgusting. It's fake studies, and it may well be illegal," Mr. Milonov told the Christian Science Monitor. In Hungary and Poland, gender studies has also been a flashpoint of political controversy, drawing the ire of political leaders seeking to paint universities as bastions of liberal indoctrination. As Andrea Petot relates in her study, Report from the Trenches, the debate around teaching gender studies in Hungary, the Undersecretary of the Hungarian Ministry of Human Resources, Benc Retvári, compared gender studies to Marxist-Leninism, again, the standard boogeyman of fascist regimes. As in Russia and Eastern Europe, attacking gender studies is an explicit part of the far-right movement in the United States. In 2010, the state legislature of North Carolina was taken over by Republicans affiliated with the far-right Tea Party movement. Together with the Republican governor, Pat McCrory, they went after the distinguished institution, the University of North Carolina. A newly appointed board of governors of the university dismissed its widely admired progressive president, Tom Ross. Governor McCrory said in an interview that public universities should not teach courses in gender studies or Swahili. Swahili is an African language spoken by 140 million people as a first or second language. McCrory added, "If you want to take gender studies, that's fine. Go to a private school and take it." Some will argue that a university must have representatives of all positions, and that changes such as those made in North Carolina merely make room for opposing perspectives. These arguments rest on the grounds that being justified in our own positions requires regularly grappling with opposing ones, as well as on the grounds that there was no room in the first place. Anyone who has taught philosophy knows that it is often useful to confront cogent defenses of opposing positions, and universities unquestionably benefit from intelligent and sophisticated proponents of positions along the political spectrum. Nevertheless, the general principle in these instances is not, upon reflection, particularly plausible. No one thinks that the demands of free inquiry require adding researchers to university faculties who seek to demonstrate that the Earth is flat. Such a position we have determined through conclusive scientific inquiry to be fruitless. Even the most ardent defender of free speech does not argue that we should spend precious university resources on this question. Adding a flat earther would, rather, impede objective inquiry. Similarly, I can safely and justifiably reject ISIS ideology without having to confront its advocates in the classroom or faculty lounge. I do not need to have a colleague who defends the view that Jewish people are genetically predisposed to greed in order to justifiably reject such anti-Semitic nonsense. Nor is it even remotely plausible that adding such voices to the faculty lounge would aid arguments against such toxic ideologies. More likely, so doing would undermine intelligent debate by leading to breakdowns of communication and shouting matches. Fascist politics, however, makes room for the study of myths as fact. In fascist ideology, the function of the education system is to glorify the mythic past, elevating the achievements of members of the nation and obscuring the perspectives and histories of those who do not belong. In a process sometimes tendentiously called decolonizing the curriculum, neglected perspectives are incorporated, thereby ensuring that students have a full view of history's actors. In the fight against fascism, adjusting the curriculum in this way is not mere political correctness. Representing the voices of all of those whose existence has shaped and formed the world in which we live, provides an essential means of protection against fascist myth. In fascist ideology, the goal of general education in the schools and universities is to instill pride in the mythic past. Fascist education extols academic disciplines that reinforce hierarchical norms and national tradition. For the fascist, schools and universities are there to indoctrinate national or racial pride, conveying, for example, where nationalism is racialized, the glorious achievements of the dominant race. Governor McCrory did not stop with his suggestion that some courses should be removed from the public curriculum. He also called on the university to focus more on the type of skills-based education that employers supposedly need, to the detriment of subjects like sociology, which aids students in becoming better democratic citizens. He was backed up by the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, run and funded by Art Pope, North Carolina's immensely powerful and wealthy Republican donor, which has successfully urged the University of North Carolina to raise its tuition. As Pope incisively recognizes, this move will lead more students away from humanities and social sciences and into majors that will give them business skills. At the same time that it denigrates teaching subjects that would enable a greater understanding of human cultural diversity, the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, now known as the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, urges the teaching of a Great Books curriculum, which emphasizes the cultural achievements of white Europeans. The priorities here make sense when one realizes that in anti-democratic systems, the function of education is to produce obedient citizens structurally obliged to enter the workforce without bargaining power and ideologically trained to think that the dominant group represents history's greatest civilizational forces. Conservative figures pour huge sums into the project of advancing right-wing goals in education. For example, in 2017, the Charles Koch Foundation, just one of the conservative foundations in the United States funded by right-wing oligarchs, alone spent $100 million to support projects largely devoted to conservative ideology at around 350 colleges and universities, according to some sources. In fascist ideology, the products of intellectual life that it supports, culture, civilization, and art, are solely productions of members of the chosen nation. When universities restrict their required offerings to the European cultural touchstones, they risk suggesting that white Europeans constitute the core of human civilization. It should give fans of such great books, programs, pause that Hitler declares in Mein Kampf that all that we admire on this earth, science, art, technical skill, and invention, is the creative product of only a small number of nations. All this culture depends on them for its very existence. If we divide the human race into three categories, founders, maintainers, and destroyers of culture, the Aryan stock alone can be considered as representing the first category. Our universities must not be complicit, even unwittingly, in promulgating such fascist myths. Across time and place, as fascism rises, so too do figures who call for stacking the schools and universities with teachers more sympathetic to the nationalist or traditionalist ideals. What has been happening in Hungary is a classic example. When Viktor Orbán assumed power, he condemned the schools as sites for liberal indoctrination. He nationalized the school system, which was previously under local school board control, and introduced a professional organization that all teachers had to join, which bound them to serve in the interests of the nation. A new national core curriculum recommended the work of anti-Semitic Hungarian writers. Schools were told to encourage activities evocative of a glorious mythic Hungarian national past, such as horseback riding and the singing of Hungarian folk songs. The best university in Hungary is Central European University, CEU, which retains independence from the Hungarian state. Orbán presents CEU as a foreign institution that seeks to displace local Hungarian schools, spreading liberal universalist values such as pro-immigration sentiment. In April 2017, the Hungarian parliament attached legislation to an anti-immigration bill seeking to strip CEU of its ability to operate as an American university in Hungary and regulating the movement of its faculty and students for national security reasons. As a consequence, CEU might close its doors in Hungary. Similar efforts to shape curricula to nationalist ends are underway around the world, including in Turkey, where one of the first actions Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan undertook after the attempted coup against him in 2016 was to dismiss more than 5,000 deans and academics from their posts in Turkish universities for suspicion of pro-democratic or pro-leftist sentiments. Many were also imprisoned. In an interview with Voice of America for a February 2017 article, İsmet Akça, a political science professor who was removed from his position at Istanbul Yildiz Technical University, said, "These people being purged are not just democratic left-oriented people. They are very good scientists, very good academics. By purging them, the government is also attacking the very idea of the higher education, the very idea of the universities in this country." In 2017, after winning a national referendum giving him new, sweeping, almost dictatorial powers, Erdogan introduced a new educational curriculum for the schools. Its goal was to de-emphasize secular ideals and eliminate scientific theories that run counter to religious ideology, such as evolution. The education ministry declared that Turkey's history would be taught from the perspective of a national and moral education, with the aim of protecting national values, rather than reflecting the secular liberal ideals that had been at the center of Turkish civil society, including its education system, since Kemal Atatürk. The far-right American radio host Rush Limbaugh has, on his popular radio show, denounced the four corners of deceit: government, academia, science, and media. Those institutions are now corrupt and exist by virtue of deceit. That's how they promulgate themselves. It is how they prosper. Limbaugh here provides a perfect example of how fascist politics targets expertise, mocking and devaluing it. In liberal democracy, political leaders are supposed to consult with those they represent, as well as with experts and scientists who can most accurately explain the demands of reality on policy. Fascist leaders are instead men of action, with no use for consultation or deliberation. In his 1941 essay, The Rebirth of European Man, the French fascist Pierre-Dieu La Rochelle writes, "It is a type of man who rejects culture. It is a man who does not believe in ideas, and hence rejects doctrines. It is a man who only believes in acts, and carries out these acts in line with a nebulous myth." Once universities and experts have been delegitimized, fascist politicians are free to create their own realities, shaped by their own individual will. Limbaugh has been attacking science for many years, proclaiming that science has become a home for displaced socialists and communists. In the current moment in U.S. politics, when climate science is mocked and derided by Trump and his administration, we see the triumph of the disparagement of scientific expertise. By rejecting the value of expertise, fascist politicians also remove any requirement for sophisticated debate. Reality is always more complex than our means of representing it. Scientific language requires even more complex terminology to make distinctions that would be invisible without it. social reality is at least as complex as the reality of physics. In a healthy liberal democracy, a public language with a rich and varied vocabulary to make distinctions is a vital democratic institution. Without it, healthy public discourse is impossible. Fascist politics seeks to degrade and debase the language of politics. Fascist politics thereby seeks to mask reality. Victor Klemperer's 1947 work, The Language of the Third Reich, is about the language of National Socialism, which he calls LTI, short for Lingua Tertii Imperii. Chapter 3, entitled Distinguishing Feature, Poverty, begins, "The LTI is destitute. Its poverty is a fundamental one. It is as if it had sworn a vow of poverty." Adolf Hitler was very explicit about the importance of impoverishing public discourse in this manner. In his chapter on propaganda in Mein Kampf, he writes, "All propaganda should be popular and should adapt its intellectual level to the receptive ability of the least intellectual of those whom it is desired to address. Thus, it must sink its mental elevation deeper in proportion to the numbers of the mass whom it has to grip. The receptive ability of the masses is very limited, and their understanding small. On the other hand, they have a great power of forgetting. This being so, all effective propaganda must be confined to very few points, which must be brought out in the form of slogans." In a healthy liberal democracy, language is a tool of information. The goal of fascist propaganda is not merely to mock and sneer at robust and complex public debate about policy. It is to eliminate its possibility. According to Klemperer, "Every language able to assert itself freely fulfills all human needs. It serves reason as well as emotion. It is communication and conversation, soliloquy and prayer, plea, command, and invocation. The LTI only serves the cause of invocation. The sole purpose of LTI is to strip everyone of their individuality, to paralyze them as personalities, to make them into unthinking and docile cattle in a herd driven and hounded in a particular direction, to turn them into atoms in a huge rolling block of stone. The LTI is the language of mass fanaticism." It is a core tenet of fascist politics that the goal of oratory should not be to convince the intellect, but to sway the will. The anonymous author of an article in a 1925 Italian fascist magazine writes, "The mysticism of fascism is the proof of its triumph. Reasoning does not attract. Emotion does." In Mein Kampf, in a chapter entitled "The Struggle in the Early Days, The Role of the Orator," Hitler writes that it is a gross misunderstanding to dismiss simple language as stupid. Throughout Mein Kampf, Hitler is clear that the aim of propaganda is to replace reasoned argument in the public sphere with irrational fears and passions. In a February 2018 interview, Steve Bannon said, "We got elected on drain the swamp, lock her up, build a wall." This was pure anger. Anger and fear is what gets people to the polls. Across the world right now, we see far-right movements attacking universities for spreading Marxism and feminism and failing to give a central place to far-right values. Even in the United States, home to the world's greatest university system, we see Eastern European-style attacks on universities. Student protests are misrepresented in the press as riots by undisciplined mobs, threats to the civil order. In fascist politics, universities are debased in public discourse, and academics are undermined as legitimate sources of knowledge and expertise, represented as radical Marxists or feminists, spreading a leftist ideological agenda under the guise of research. By debasing institutions of higher learning and impoverishing our joint vocabulary to discuss policy, fascist politics reduces debate to ideological conflict. Via such strategies, fascist politics degrades information spaces, occluding reality. Chapter 4. Unreality. When propaganda succeeds at twisting ideals against themselves and universities are undermined and condemned as sources of bias, reality itself is cast into doubt. We can't agree on truth. Fascist politics replaces reasoned debate with fear and anger. When it is successful, its audience is left with a destabilized sense of loss and a well of mistrust and anger against those who it has been told are responsible for this loss. Fascist politics exchanges reality for the pronouncements of a single individual or perhaps a political party. Regular and repeated obvious lying is part of the process by which fascist politics destroys the information space. A fascist leader can replace truth with power, ultimately lying without consequence. By replacing the world with a person, fascist politics makes us unable to assess arguments by a common standard. The fascist politician possesses specific techniques to destroy information spaces and break down reality. Anyone looking at current U.S. politics, or current Russian politics, or current Polish politics, would immediately note the presence and political potency of conspiracy theories. The task of defining conspiracy theories presents difficult issues. The philosopher Giulio Napolitano has suggested that we should think of conspiracy theories as aimed at some outgroup and in the service of some in-group. Conspiracy theories function to denigrate and delegitimize their targets by connecting them, mainly symbolically, to problematic acts. Conspiracy theories do not function like ordinary information. They are, after all, often so outlandish that they can hardly be expected to be literally believed. Their function is rather to raise general suspicion about the credibility and the decency of their targets. Conspiracy theories are a critical mechanism used to delegitimize the mainstream media, which fascist politicians accuse of bias for failing to cover false conspiracies. Perhaps the most famous 20th century conspiracy theory revolves around the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was at the basis of Nazi ideology. The Protocols is an early 20th century hoax, supposedly written as an instruction manual to Jews as a plot for world domination. Scholars have discovered that it was liberally plagiarized from Maurice Joly's 1864 book, A Dialogue in Hell Between Machiavelli and Montesquieu, a political satire set as a debate in hell between Montesquieu, who makes the case for liberalism, and Machiavelli, who makes the case for tyranny. Machiavelli's arguments for tyranny are transformed in the Protocols into arguments made by the Elders of Zion, supposedly Jewish leaders bent on world domination. It appears to have been published for the first time as an appendix to the Russian author and religious mystic Sergei Nilus's 1905 book, The Antichrist. In 1906, it was published serially in a St. Petersburg newspaper under the title The Conspiracy or The Roots of the Disintegration of European Society. In 1907, it appeared as a book published by the St. Petersburg Society for the Deaf and Dumb. It sold millions of copies throughout the world in the 1920s, including in the United States, where 500,000 copies were mass-produced and distributed by Henry Ford, the automaker, by 1925. According to the Protocols, Jews are at the center of a global conspiracy that dominates the most respected mainstream media outlets and the global economic system, using them to spread democracy, capitalism, and communism, all masks for Jewish interests. The most prominent and influential Nazi leaders, including Hitler and Goebbels, firmly believed this conspiracy theory to be true. Throughout Nazi writings, we find denunciations of the Jewish press for failure to denounce or even mention the international Jewish conspiracy. The 2016 U.S. presidential election was marred by a series of conspiracy theories. These were aimed against several targets, including Hillary Clinton, the Democratic candidate, as well as Muslims and refugees. Perhaps the most bizarre such theory was Pizzagate. According to those who spread it, leaked emails from John Podesta, Clinton's campaign manager, were said to spell out secret coded messages about the trafficking of young children for sex to Democratic congressmen, conducted from a pizzeria in Washington, D.C. The theories were circulated on social media and, given their bizarre nature, achieved surprisingly wide currency. Though it was just one among several bizarre conspiracy theories about Clinton and the Democrats, it received outsized national attention, not just for its extreme oddity, but because Edgar Madison Welch, a man from North Carolina, actually showed up, gun in hand, at the pizzeria to confront its owners and free the supposed sexual slaves. The goal of this conspiracy was to connect its targets, Democrats, to acts of extreme depravity. The University of Connecticut philosopher Michael Lynch has used the example of Pizzagate as evidence for the thesis that conspiracy theories are not intended to be treated as ordinary information. Lynch points out that if one were actually supposed to believe that there was a pizzeria in Washington, D.C., that was trafficking in child sex slaves for Democratic congressmen, it would be entirely rational to act as Edgar Madison Welch acted. And yet, Welch was roundly condemned by those who promulgated the Pizzagate conspiracy for his actions. Lynch's point is that the Pizzagate conspiracy was not intended to be treated as ordinary information. The function of conspiracy theories is to impugn and malign their targets, but not necessarily by convincing their audience that they are true. In the case of Pizzagate, the conspiracy theory was intended to remain at the level of innuendo and slander. Donald Trump came to mainstream political attention by attacking the press for their supposed censorship of the conspiracy theory called birtherism, the belief that President Obama was born in Kenya and therefore not eligible to be president of the United States. In an interview with CNN on May 29, 2012, Trump railed at Wolf Blitzer and CNN for not covering the topic because, according to Trump, they were working for Obama. Fox News, in contrast, provided Trump a ready platform to promote his conspiracy theories. President Trump is not an outlier here. Conspiracy theories are the calling cards of fascist politics. Conspiracy theories are tools to attack those who would ignore their existence. By not covering them, the media is made to appear biased and ultimately part of the very conspiracy they refuse to cover. Conspiracy theories not only have the power to influence perceptions of reality, they can also shape the course of real events. Poland's ruling far-right party, PIS, is best known for its social conservatism and its disdain for liberal democratic institutions. But it is less often noted outside Poland that PIS came to power on the wings of conspiracy theories every bit as fantastical as the birtherism conspiracy that ushered Donald Trump into the mainstream of U.S. politics and eventually the presidency. On April 10, 2010, a plane carrying Polish President Lech Kaczynski and the First Lady, as well as the entire General Army Command of the Polish Armed Forces, the President of the National Bank, and many other members of the Polish political elite, crashed in a four-